Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us for the next few minutes, Father Richard John Newhouse, to talk about the Catholic vote. It is perhaps one of the hottest topics in the general subject of faith and politics in the last several months. We're going to talk about the Catholic vote. Father Richard John Newhouse is a regular guest. He's editor-in-chief of First Things, a journal of religion and public life, and he's author of the classic book, The Naked Public Square. Father Newhouse, welcome back.
It's always good to be with you.
I guess the biggest question on my mind right now with regard to Senator John Kerry, the challenger to President George W. Bush, is in what sense is he Roman Catholic?
Oh, well, I mean, he's, to use somewhat technical Catholic language, he is baptized into the communion of the Catholic Church. But his communion with the Church, his unity with the Church, is, we say, impaired. He's not excommunicate, but it is impaired by the fact that he has publicly, persistently, and defiantly rejected both moral reason and the Church's teaching with regard to the intrinsic evil of deliberately taking innocent human life.
Is it too simple to say that Senator Kerry, and in this sense he's not unique to either Roman Catholic politicians, some, or to Roman Catholic voters, that he is Catholic on his own terms?
Well, yes, that apparently is what he's attempting to do. I mean, he says that, you know, for bishops, that bishops have no business instructing politicians. Well, that's what bishops are supposed to do, is instruct the faithful. And if the politician claims to be a faithful Catholic, that's precisely the task of a bishop. One is reminded, it was Davis Gray, the former governor of California, who, when the same issue came up with regard to his pro-abortion stance, and the bishop pointed out the difficulty of his being in impaired communion with the Church, former Governor Gray said, "We've come to a fine pass when bishops try to tell people how to practice their faith." Well, some of us thought that's exactly what bishops are ordained to do.
There are some bishops who have suggested that as a public official I must cast votes or take public positions on issues like a woman's right to choose or stem cell research that carry out the tenets of the Catholic Church. I love my church. I respect the bishops, but I respectfully disagree.
Father Newhouse, do you agree with Senator Kerry? That sounds not so much like the Gray Davis, "The bishops are trying to tell me what to do," but it sounds like a different nuance there.
Well, it's odd with Senator Kerry. I mean, in that context, the quote you have there, and then he has regularly said on this stump, that, you know, his religious faith, he's a very serious Catholic, he says, and his religious faith informs everything he does and his thinking about environment, about tax equality, about health care, etc. Well, but then when it comes to this one issue, the only issue on which the Church makes clear that both moral and divine law provide no wiggle room whatsoever, on this one issue, he says he will not impose his faith, after saying that on all the other issues he is acting on the basis of his faith. So what one has here is a instance of deep incoherence.
I'd like your assessment of the Vatican statement that came out recently that was addressed, it seems, although it was addressed to the entire worldwide political situation, it seems as though it was more or less addressed to the American political situation during this presidential campaign. What did you think of it?
Well, which statement do you mean now? With regard to the role of abortion in political life?
Yes.
It was a statement by Cardinal Ratzinger from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith directed to the American bishops who were meeting in June, and came up with a statement called Catholics in Political Life, which is a rather firm statement indicating that every bishop had a responsibility to address the public scandal. Now, this is not a question of looking into a person's soul and judging the state of the inner sanctum of their soul. The church doesn't presume to do that. Only God knows what's going on inside a person's mind and soul. But the statement clearly says that when one publicly claims at the same time to be a faithful Catholic and rejects the church's teaching and the teaching of clear moral reason, that then there is a problem that must be confronted, and it must be confronted publicly because the scandal is public. Scandal here meaning, in a sense, that Catholics use it not just something that is notorious, but something that confuses the faithful with respect to the most important thing in our lives, which is the faith.
Were you at all familiar with the voter's guide? It's called a voter's guide that was issued by the Catholic Answers Organization.
Mm-hmm.
What was your assessment there?
I think it was a legitimate effort. I think that perhaps when you move away from the question of public figures and public scandal and get to the question of the individual voter, it may well be that a Catholic is simply not thinking clearly. I mean, the church's teaching is that you are to vote according to your conscience, and then you are obliged to have a well-formed conscience, an informed conscience, and that means that conscience is not simply how you feel about something, but conscience is the God-given capacity to seek the truth and to act in the truth. And I think maybe that voter's guide perhaps does not, make enough allowance for individual Catholics who may simply be confused. I mean, the voter's guide and the logic of a number of outstanding bishops, Archbishop Burke of St. Louis, Archbishop Chaput of Denver, and many others, is exactly right. The logic is exactly right. But I think any pastor knows that people are often not acting on the basis of clear logic. And therefore, that does not create the problem pastorally that is created by someone like John Kerry and many, many others, needless to say, who, as I said earlier, create a public confusion about what is, in fact, the teaching of the church.
How do you evaluate St. Louis Archbishop Raymond Burke's statements? And they've been several, and over the last several months, on this issue.
Oh, I think Archbishop Burke is a very clear-thinking and courageous and conscientious pastor, and has rendered an enormous service not only for the Catholics of St. Louis, but for the public witness in St. Louis and indeed in the nation.
The ethical test of a good society is how it treats its most vulnerable members.
Father Newhouse, do you agree with Senator Kerry on that point?
Yes, emphatically. And all he has to then add is that there is no more vulnerable member of the human community than the innocent unborn children and people at the end of life who are in danger of euthanasia and mercy killing. In other words, we just have to specify who are the most vulnerable and to recognize that, you know, here's the major question. It's a question around which the whole abortion dispute turns. Who belongs to the community for which we accept common responsibility? That these are lives and that they are human lives, there's no dispute about that. That's established scientifically, medically, biologically, beyond dispute. The question is, do we acknowledge them as members of the community for which we accept common responsibility?
Father Newhouse, finally, which candidate will take the majority of Catholic votes tomorrow?
Oh, I don't know. My hunch is probably President Bush, but we'll both know more about that within a matter of 48 hours or so.
Folks, the website for First Things, a journal of religion and public life, is firstthings.com. That's firstthings.com. Father Richard John Newhouse is editor-in-chief of First Things and author of the classic book, The Naked Public Square. Father Newhouse, we thank you for your time and thanks for being a guest.
It's always a pleasure to be with you. God bless.
Now for the remainder of the program, we'll be signing off a little bit early today because of the time change. We're going to be talking with Frank Beckwith. Frank joins us. He's Associate Professor of Church and State Studies and Associate Director of the J.M. Dawson Institute of Church State Studies at Baylor University. He's a regular guest on the program, author of an article in the Christian Research Journal titled Wise as Serpents, Christians, Politics, and Strategic Voting. Dr. Frank Beckwith, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Well, thanks for having me back.
Okay, so we're on this eve of this election, and I am a pro-life voter. Tell me, does every pro-life vote ultimately further the pro-life position?
Well, not necessarily, and this is the argument that I make in the article that you mentioned earlier. And by the way, if people want to get that article, they can get it free on my website, francisbeckwith.com. I was able to get a copy of that for people to access at their leisure. But the argument that I offer is this. It has to do with the fact that oftentimes Christians who are interested in certain social issues are unaware of how our government works. We have a government that is a separation of powers. That means that each branch of government has a different role or sphere or authority concerning certain matters. A legislative branch legislates, the judicial branch makes judgments, and the executive branch carries out the laws and is involved with police powers. What happens in the legislative branch, in the branch in which we would hope that there are laws that advance the pro-life position, is that before a bill becomes a law, it's got to go through committee. And the people that chair these committees are those selected by the party that's the majority party in the legislature. So, for example, there may be a situation, and I use an illustration similar to this in my article, there may be a situation in which a pro-life Christian may vote for somebody who is not necessarily pro-life but belongs to a party that is largely pro-life, that is to say a political party that embraces the pro-life position in its platform, because he or she knows that that party, if it's in the majority, will place people in the right positions as chair and leadership that will be able to get those bills up for consideration, whereas the other party may have members who are pro-life, but they may very well not advance the cause because their platform doesn't maintain those beliefs, and for that reason, they're not going to get those bills through.
Okay, so the example I think about is Arlen Specter, in which here is a guy who is not pro-life, but President George W. Bush, who is pro-life, campaigned for him in order to hold a Republican majority in that particular branch of government. And one might argue that the president there was acting in the interest of furthering a pro-life position. Would you agree?
Yes, I think that, you know, in those cases where you have, in the case of Specter, who's a kind of a middle of the road, somewhat liberal Republican, you know, he's got to get financial and political support from the party, which is largely conservative. And so, if he's reelected, and it looks like he will be tomorrow, he is going to have to owe the president. And that means that, you know, he'll have to push certain things through that he may otherwise not want. But that's the way politics is. And I know it's somewhat disconcerting for Christians to hear this. But look, we live in a fallen world, and the separation of powers is probably the best way to harness our wicked natures for the good.
Okay. A lot of this seems to be dependent upon and in the context of the fact that we are a two-party system in the United States. I mean, there are other parties, there are alternatives, but none of them really match the two parties, Republican and Democratic, in their scope or their influence or the number of people who are elected to those parties. Is that important to remember here, too, our two-party system?
That's right. Unlike other parts of the world in which certain nations have multiple parties, especially in a parliamentary system, the United States has two parties. Now, some people decry that because they think, well, every point of view should be represented. I don't actually hold that view. I hold the view that two parties is a good thing because within each party there are a wide range of views. But because we live in a two-party system, or we have our government largely embraces that by the way in which our elections are run, that you're more likely going to be have, if you want your particular view advanced, you're more likely to advance it by supporting a party that largely accepts your views. And at the end of the day, voting for the person is not a smart thing to do. I know a lot of people say that, and they think it's noble. I have relatives say, I vote for the party, I vote for the man. And my response is, you don't understand American politics.
Our call-in numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Frank Beckwith is our guest. We're talking about Christians and what he calls strategic pro-life voting. Let's go to the phones and talk with Mike, who's calling from Pennsylvania. Mike, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, I was calling in to comment on his Spectre comment. Mm-hmm. Well, we were talking about this at church, actually, the other day, and Spectre being pro-choice and also senior and on the judicial committee, he would have the power to block and prevent a pro-life candidate from a judge nomination to get to the floor. Well, we were talking about would it be better to have a freshman pro-choicer in opposed to a senior pro-choicer, and we were talking about this yesterday, and some of us are agreeing that maybe it might be better if Spector lost because he may not vote with the president. Mm. So we were saying it would be better to have the freshman with no seniority in, while Spector having seniority could actually become like the leader of the Judicial Review Board.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, every situation is obviously complex, and this one is pretty complex. The only reason why I would discourage people to vote for, let's say, Spector's opponent, who is a Democrat, is that the Democratic Party largely embraces a pro-choice position, and so what may happen? I mean, supposing that the balance of power shifts to the Democrats, it really doesn't matter then whether Spector's someone of Spector's views is representing Pennsylvania. What's important is that someone from a particular party represents Pennsylvania. In the case of Spector, it's not as easy as you think for people in the Senate to do whatever they please. Chairmanships are based on seniority, that's right. But they're not always given based exclusively on that factor. If someone like Spector stepped too much out of line, you bet your bottom dollar that Bill Frist would receive a phone call. Bill Frist, by the way, is the majority leader of the Senate, would receive a call from the White House discouraging giving that individual any more power. So, you know, it's politics is a funny thing. It's not always as easy as you think because there are so many different factions and so many different groups that are vying for somebody's power that they really can't afford to be too gung-ho in one direction.
Let's go into your two examples that you cite as examples of strategic pro-life voting. The first one, you cite a hypothetical Mr. Smith who's running against a Mr. Jones. Tell us about this example.
That's right. What happens in that particular scenario is you have two individuals who are vying for, if I can remember it, I'm actually have to remember my own illustration.
I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Well, what you have here is you say,
excuse me.
You say that Mr. Smith is running against Mr. Jones for a state assembly. Mr. Smith is strongly pro-abortion, while Mr. Jones is strongly pro-life.
Okay, yeah, that's the state assembly one. Yeah, this is one in which you have the balance of power in the assembly is going to fall on this particular election. That is, you have a pro-choice candidate who belongs to a pro-life party and a pro-life candidate who belongs to a pro-choice party. And you're the pro-lifer who is, let's say, at the ballot box and you have to decide who to vote for. I suggest you vote for the pro-choicer who belongs to the pro-life party because it will turn out that that party will have the chairmanships of all the important committees that involve legislation that will touch on those issues. And so in that case, you have an individual who may not agree with your position, but being in the legislature actually winds up advancing your point of view than if you'd voted for the other person strictly based on principle. Or I don't think it really is principle, but many Christians say that. I know that some Christian leaders will say they would never vote for somebody who's not pro-life, and I think that is, as I said earlier, not not very, I think it shows a lack of awareness of how our politics works.
Are presidential politics a little different in this sense, in that the president is the executive branch, for all intents and purposes?
That's right.
And while he has to deal with his party and he has to deal with the legislatures, if you've got the choice between a pro-life president and a pro-choice president, if you've got a choice between those two candidates, it's hard to argue that you could nuance that, or that it would be necessary to nuance that.
Yeah, the executive branch has different powers. That's a very good point. And for that reason, if you, let's say, had a pro-life legislature and a pro-choice president, my lord, any piece of legislation coming through could be vetoed. You'd need two-thirds of both houses of Congress to overturn that, and that very rarely happens. In fact, that's what happened largely in the late 1990s when Clinton was president. He had a very conservative House and Senate who a number of times tried to pass a partial birth abortion ban, and he vetoed it. George Bush signed it. So it does make a difference. And of course, you can think of the situation with the other way around. We have a conservative pro-life president who has a legislature, both houses of Congress, that are, let's say, pro-choice or at least not strongly pro-life. That gives the president an opportunity to cut deals. That is, he can say, look, back off on this abortion legislation and, you know, I'll support you on this other bill that we both agree on. So there's a lot more leverage if you have a president who is pro-life. And plus, the president also has the important responsibility of selecting members of the judiciary. And the judiciary obviously includes the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court deals with these issues, and they are the final arbiter on them. So the president not only has powers that are part of his office, but he also has the opportunity to select people in the other branch of government.
That brings us to your second example, and we've got only about a minute here before we go to this break, but let's get started with the example of the Supreme Court that stands only one vote short of overturning Roe v. Wade.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and this one, it's a little bit more complicated than the first one, so I'll briefly present it, and then I guess after the break we can
let's do that.
We can, you know, go over it in greater detail. The Supreme Court's on the verge of overturning Roe v. Wade. They're one vote short, and you happen to live in a state that is fairly liberal, so it's not going to be a state that even if Roe v. Wade is overturned, in which abortion will probably be forbidden. And because of that, it is unlikely that you will be able to elect to the Senate anybody who is even remotely pro-life. Supposing that you are voting in a primary race and you've got three candidates, one candidate, a woman candidate who is extremely pro-life, I called her Miss Johnson, and then you have another one named Mr. Adams and Mr. Baker. Mr. Adams is a pro-abortion atheist who is moderate on other issues such as sex education and gay rights. Mr. Baker is moderate on abortion, but he's liberal on other issues, such as gay rights and school vouchers. It turns out, though, that you know through polling that Mr. Adams has a much better chance to beat the member of the other party who he will go against, the incumbent, for the general election. And it turns out the incumbent is part of the pro-abortion party. I argue that strategic voting entails voting for Mr. Adams.
Well, let's sort that out when we come back. It's a complex situation, but isn't that what politics is made up of? All sorts of little complex situations just like that. We'll be right back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
You know, you can walk into just about any Christian bookstore, and you're sure to find lots of advice on the subject of parenting. But most of these books contain lots of psychology and very little theology, lots of law, and very little gospel. That's why Issues Etc. and Concordia Publishing House are excited about our Books of the Month for November. Two books from the series titled Faithfully Parenting. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or to find out more about the Faithfully Parenting series on our website, just check issuesetc.org and click the What's New section. You can order Faithfully Parenting Teens or Faithfully Parenting Preschoolers for only $9.99 each, plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. Two books from the Faithfully Parenting series, our Issues Etc. Books of the Month for November.
Butterflies. Now, why do they flutter?
Answers with Ken Ham, a well-known speaker and author on defending the authority of the Bible. Well, butterflies usually look like they're just randomly fluttering their wings, Ken, and that there's no apparent pattern to their flight. But I don't think that's the case, right?
Well, in the last decade, researchers have discovered a variety of ways that butterflies use their wings to stay aloft. Some are quite unconventional, actually. For example, one particular movement creates a spiraling airflow along the edges of the wings. Now, this generates some of the lift that even modern aerodynamics research can't account for. After filming a Red Admiral butterfly in a wind tunnel, researchers were surprised to find a whole range of complicated wing movements, and they generate more lift than simple flapping would do. The complexity of this butterfly's wing movements completely baffled the aeronautical engineers. As one of them stated, the fluttering of butterflies is not random, erratic wandering, but results from the mastery of a wide array of aerodynamic mechanisms. One commentator observed, "If engineers ever understood that, there'll be a revolution in aeronautics." Well, there is one engineer who already understands. He's the one who originally put these flying marvels together in the first place. The Lord, the maker of the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that in them is, including the butterflies. Let's praise him.
Is it possible that God made life in outer space? Ken Ham tackles that question on our website, answersradio.com.
Dr. Carl Fakencher of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on good reasons to become a pastor.
Before I went to the seminary, I worked in business for a number of years, and I enjoyed very much what I was doing, but I realized that the aspects of my jobs that I appreciated the most certainly were the opportunities to be helpful and encouraging and supportive of the people who worked with me. And it was quite clear to me, without any question, that the way I could be most helpful to them was sharing the good news of Jesus Christ, their Savior. And I realized that if I became a pastor, that would be what I'd do all the time, and I would never be restricted in any way in what I could say. The help that I could bring to people that I cared about would be the help that was not just for today or tomorrow, but eternal.
To schedule an on-campus visit at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, call 1-800-481-2155.
Do you want more of God's grace? Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights is a Bible-believing church, faithful to the Scriptures, a place for the whole family, a community gathered around Christ that cares with a vibrant historic Christian liturgy. Bethany Lutheran Church is located at 5600 Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights. Visit them at www.bethanylcms.org.
Folks, now is the time to register for the 2005 Symposia Series at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. It's the 20th Annual Symposium on Exegetical Theology and the 28th Annual Symposium on the Lutheran Confessions. Both of those are going to take place January the 18th through the 21st, 2005, on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary. This continues the long tradition of bringing well-known theologians from around the world. And it continues with this year's speakers. If you'd like a list of those speakers for the 2005 Symposia Series at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, you can go to their website, www.ctsfw.edu. You can also look at the schedule there, or you can even register for the Symposia Series online, www.ctsfw. When you get there, just click on Events and then click on Symposia. It's all there for you at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. Frank Beckwith is our guest. We're talking about Christians and strategic voting. Okay, before the break, you laid out the scenario in which we have Ms. Johnson, a devout pro-life Christian, who's maybe a racist. Who knows? Adams.
According to my story, she said a few things that could be interpreted that way. And as you know, in politics, interpreted that way could mean that she's really not. But the other side spins it that way.
Okay, so then there's Mr. Adams. He's a pro-abortion atheist who's moderate on other issues, and then Mr. Baker, who's a moderate on abortion.
Yeah, but is liberal on other issues. The difference, though, between the three of them, clearly Ms. Johnson, because it's a liberal state, is not going to really have much of a chance to win. In fact, virtually no chance. The other thing that's important is that the incumbent is part of the minority party, and he's also quite influential on the Senate Judiciary Committee, which decides, interviews people that have been nominated for the federal courts by the president, who happens to be, in my fictional scenario, very pro-life. So it really is between Adams and Baker. And Adams has promised the president that if he is elected, that he will support the president's agenda of having a more conservative court. Yet, Mr. Baker never made that promise. And so what I argue is that strategically, it would be wise to vote for Mr. Adams, even though he's the least pro-life of the three. He's the one that is going to do the work for the cause on behalf of the president.
He's the one who's going to make it most likely that the president can have a court that will overturn Roe.
That's right. And whereas Mr. Baker, though he's moderate on the issue, he doesn't seem to want to, you know, to do that sort of work. Now, I actually have had, you know, since this has come out, I've had actually a lot of email from people, and one person pointed out to me that how can we trust politicians, and use the illustration of a couple of Supreme Court nominees that were selected by conservative presidents who wound up not voting that way on the abortion issue, and the three that he mentioned were Souter, O'Connor, and Kennedy. And I my response was that was, first off, it's a very good question, but there's a difference between being a judicial appointment and being a legislator. A legislator is held accountable not only to his or her constituency, but to, in this case, the president. I mean, imagine if this fellow had, you know, after he got elected, assuming he got elected, he simply, broke his promise to the president. Well, it's not that easy to do in politics. First off, the president is the leader of the party. That is, if he's the highest ranking member of his party in the government. And he's going to make sure that this individual does not receive the sort of donations that he wants. In addition to that, he may run somebody in the primary against him to knock him out of office. So, you know, it's not as easy as people think. It's not like a judicial appointment. Legislators have a lot of people that they have to answer to. And so I think it's pretty safe to think that an individual who makes that promise will likely keep it.
Now, your illustration also illustrates something that you mentioned before, and it brings up the issue of, as you kind of mentioned, voting on principle narrowly defined. That is,
yeah,
the person who says, I know that the person I'm voting for does not have a snowball's chance,
yeah,
of being elected, but I'm going to vote for him anyway, and I know I'm, quote-unquote, throwing my vote away, but I'm going to vote on principle. How do you respond to such a person?
Well, I think it's a... As I said, it's earlier, it's a misunderstanding of the nature of our politics. The question that I think each person has to ask himself or herself is this: do you want to advance the public good? To advance the public good means that we ought to place laws in our communities that protect human beings. And that just doesn't refer to the issue of abortion, but it refers to the wide scope of protections. It may involve protecting parents so that they can educate their children consistently with their religious tradition. It may mean programs that help the poor. It could mean a variety of things. But if you want to do that, you have to understand the nature of our system. And sometimes doing things based on quote-unquote principle in the long run actually undermines your advancement of the public good. Now, there could be many reasons why somebody wants to send a message by voting a particular way, and I don't think that's always wrong to do that. But I think the best way to send a message is not to throw your vote away, but to be involved with party politics. I mean, a lot of people don't know how easy it is to get involved with party politics. You've got to attend county meetings, state meetings, and you get elected to certain committees, and those individuals are the ones that really influence the platform and the principles that the party stands for. When I was in Nevada, I did much of that. I've done less of it here in Texas because I just haven't had the chance. But Nevada, I was chairman of the Republican Platform Committee for my county. I was a delegate to the state convention, and in '92 as a delegate to the national convention. I had only been involved for 3 or 4 years. So it's not that difficult to do if you put the time and effort into it, and that's where the real work gets done.
All right, we have very, very little time here. Let's take a phone call. Joe is calling from his car. Joe, our time is very tight.
Hi, my question is, I struggled with President Bush when he kind of, what I thought was pandering to illegal aliens and corporations' demands to have aliens available for the workforce. In my mind, that undermines the pro-life platform in the sense that we aborted our workforce for the last 30-plus years. Tell me if I'm wrong, and please tell me why I'm wrong if I am.
We've only got 1 minute here to respond to Joe's
Really good question. It has to do with the relationship between our population base and abortion. And there's no doubt that abortion over the past 30 or so years has actually resulted in fewer workers and a lower gross domestic product. That's been shown by a number of writers, including Cal Beisner in a book that he wrote several years ago on wealth and poverty. I don't know how that ties into the question of illegal immigrants coming to the United States. My sense is that if there's a market for those jobs, they wouldn't be crossing the border. It's a highly complex issue, one that I'm certainly not an expert on. But I think the one thing that the president was probably afraid of was that to be perceived as somebody who, let's say, wanted to single out a particular ethnic group for exclusion. I don't know if that's the wisest way to go about it, but I do think that probably factored in politically.
With only about a minute here, Frank, or less than a minute, only 30 seconds, having a hard time making this case with pro-life voters?
You know what? It's interesting. Not as difficult as you think. I think it has to be explained to them. I think that it would be wonderful if pro-life organizations offered civics classes in churches around the country. I mean, it would be wonderful to teach people. I mean, a lot of us learn this in high school, but we forget about it. And part of my job here at Baylor, I'm professor of church-state studies, so I teach this to undergraduates all the time, so it's second nature to me. But a lot of people aren't aware of how our system works. And it'd be great if Christian pro-life organizations began offering around election time civics classes.
Well, thank you for joining us and giving us the briefest primer in civics class. Regarding that, Frank Beckwith, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thanks for having me.
You can read Dr. Frank Beckwith's article called Wise as Serpents, Christian Politics and Strategic Voting on the web at francisbeckwith.com. It's francisbeckwith.com. Frank Beckwith is Associate Professor of Church-State Studies and Associate Director of the J.M. Dawson Institute of Church-State Studies at Baylor University, and he's authored this article in the Christian Research Journal titled Wise as Serpents, Christians, Politics, and Strategic Voting. That website address again, and for other articles as well, francisbeckwith.com, francisbeckwith.com. Tomorrow on the program, Christians and Political Activism with Greg Kokel of Stand to Reason. Can we change the culture? Is that the mandate that Christians have? You know, we can change the culture, although it's not our mandate, but it's not the way that most Christians think we change the culture. We'll talk with Greg Kokel about that tomorrow, and we'll also discuss abortion alternative legislation with Dorinda Bordley of Americans United for Life. That's tomorrow on the program. We'll also be rebroadcasting tomorrow our conversation with Alexa Kelly from the Kerry campaign, talking about faith, politics, and Democratic presidential candidate Kerry.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.